Searching for the perfect Mother's Day present? Try Sophyto Pro, that's Sophyto Pro, a natural skincare system now available exclusively through doctors and featured this month at the Hoffman Center store. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again it's time for Q&A with Layla. That's a question and answer session where we field questions from you, our listening audience, and we endeavor to answer them. It's a collaborative effort between yours truly and the Hoffman Center nutritionist, Layla Mudin, who is known to many of you who follow these podcasts. So welcome, Layla.
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. So before we get to our questions, by the way, you can email us your questions, send them to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we will answer them on our weekly podcast, Q&A with Layla. But before we get to our questions, and we have lots of them this week, did you realize, Layla, and this is just in, hot off the presses, that science has finally discovered a cure for obesity?
Hallelujah.
I mean, you were working away seeing patients at the Hoffman Center. You didn't have time to check the news. But
tell me, yes.
Okay, so, you know, we'll be giving you your termination papers tomorrow because according to
you
science.
You won't need me anymore, yeah.
Check it out. Science Daily, an authoritative news source. Headline, fattening gene discovered by researchers. That's as of today, April 30th. 2014, and this is a major milestone. The only problem is that we have now solved the problem of obesity in experimental rats.
Yeah.
Actually, in this case, mice.
Okay.
It turns out that there's a gene. It's called the SIRT7 gene. By the way, the SIRT2 gene seems to be the gene that's regulated by resveratrol, so they're kind of closely related.
Yeah.
And what they say here is that in genetically modified mice, in which they knock out the SIRT7 gene, these mice, even when fed particularly high-fat pellets for months, the equivalent of bacon cheeseburgers for mice, these mice put on significantly less weight than a comparable group who did not have the SIRT7 gene knocked out. So, the implications for people... I don't know where this is going, but this is perhaps some insight into the physiology of overweight. And eventually, I don't know whether we're going to do gene modification in people. So far, that hasn't worked out well.
No.
Maybe we'll uncover some of the molecular mechanisms behind obesity.
Well, it's fascinating, actually, you know. There was always claimed that, oh, well, the obesity gene, the thrifty gene, all of that. So let's see where this goes.
The only problem is we actually do know that there are genes associated with overweight, but there are many of them. And so one person who's overweight might have a collection of certain obesity-promoting genes, and another person who's comparably overweight may have an entirely different set. So it's, you know, I actually coined a phrase a few years back. And if you're a Simon and Garfunkel fan, this will resonate for you. And the phrase is, there are 50 ways to keep your blubber.
Oh, you know what I used to call it? There are 50 ways to chop your liver.
Well, 50...
to keep your blubber.
By that I mean that the body has many redundant mechanisms that hold on to body fat. And this is actually a survival mechanism from time immemorial when we were faced with starvation and deprivation. And so the body actually wants to hold on to fat as a reserve against hardship and famine. Mm-hmm. And therefore, these genes are active in some people to a greater extent than others. And so if you're overweight and having a heck of a time losing weight, just recognize that you are the culmination of millions of years of exquisite evolution, and you've got survivor genes. They're there for a reason.
As opposed to Jordache genes.
Okay. Survivor genes as opposed to Jordache genes. So anyway, all kidding aside, this, you know, exciting milestone probably isn't going to make a heck of a lot of difference. You can come back to work tomorrow.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Okay,
good,
you get a know. You get a reprieve.
I get a reprieve.
Until they have the final knockout gene therapy for obesity, then that will render you superfluous. Although, look, we're not just about, obviously, weight loss at the Hoffman Center. We're giving therapeutic diets to people for various medical conditions, and that requires a great deal of expertise to wield those diets. So it's not just a matter of, we're not just a fat farm, obviously. We're working, and we prefer to work, actually, with people who have realistic weight loss goals or who have specific medical problems. Just this morning, we saw a gentleman with very severe irritable bowel syndrome, and we're trying to come up with a strategy that's going to help him reduce his symptoms. And that may require some trials at various types of diet modification, the SCD diet, the FODMAPs diet. These are some of the tools that we use in treating that. And, how many different diets do you think he administered? It's probably many dozen different diets.
At least a dozen different diets.
Okay.
So therapeutic diets are very, very powerful.
Indeed. So let's get to this week's questions. What's on our roster of questions?
Let's see. This comes from Kathy. Kathy emails us, "I will be having breast surgery in the next month. I wanted to know what I can do to help with the healing process, stage 1 breast cancer.
Okay, and that's a good thing, because stage 1 breast cancer is eminently curable, and it may require surgery to remove the cancer. So let's talk surgical recovery. We so often get that question, what do you do for surgical recovery? Well, believe it or not, breast surgery of this type is actually a relatively small surgery. There's no small surgery except a surgery that's going to be done on someone else, right? Because of your surgery, it's a big surgery. But, I can say this objectively, that it's relatively superficial. You don't have to cut into the abdomen you don't have to put a person on a heart-lung machine. It's done under light anesthesia, and it involves very superficial cutting, and the tumor is usually very close to the surface of the skin, and there's not a lot of blood loss. So it's not very traumatic. But some things that can help would be bromelain. Or Wobenzyme, sometimes a specialized product.
So you don't develop so much scar tissue.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a superficial wound like that, even if it wasn't superficial, vitamin C and zinc.
Sure.
I would say for a good month afterwards.
Right. And some things helpful to stop, we might suggest, even though it's a very superficial surgery that isn't going to involve a lot of blood loss, but not a very high dose of vitamin E, not too much in the way of garlic, and, of course, not too much in the way of fish oil for a short time before.
Yeah.
But can be resumed right after.
These are all blood thinning.
Yeah, can be resumed right after.
A reminder to anybody on aspirin therapy that the aspirin therapy should be stopped at least a week before. That's blood thinning.
Right. And they usually ask that when they're doing the pre-op, they ask what medications you're taking. So hopefully they'll spot that. Well, a more interesting question is, I know this is not the question that she asked, but what can you do once you've had the breast surgery and they say you're fine, and you ask, what else can I do to forestall breast cancer? And they'll say, if they're going to be holistic about this, so we'll eat a good diet and exercise. Mm-hmm. They will say that these days. At least they'll say it, but they won't actually give you the specifics. And when it comes to supplements, they'll say, take a multivitamin, or, supplements have not been proven to make a big difference in breast cancer.
Or don't take a multivitamin.
or don't take it. Or they might say, don't even take a multivitamin. But this is actually something that we encounter a lot, is women. There's so many women, as very young women sometimes, who come in with an early breast cancer, and they're treated and hopefully cured. But the question is, usually there is a little slight chance of recurrence. So what can you do to prevent recurrence? Well, let's go through some of the nutrients that can be used. This would be after the surgery.
Yeah, after the surgery, definitely curcumin. Curcumin, a powerful anti-inflammatory, is even in the scientific research showing it can shrink tumors. So the curcumin is something I'm very excited about.
We would also have to mention vitamin D. Vitamin D confers protection against breast cancer. EGCG from green tea. Maybe sulforaphane, Brocomax, the sulforaphane glucosinolate product. It's called Brocomax on our website at drhoffman.com. Actually formulated by researchers at Johns Hopkins University. Paul Talalay pioneered this research in discovering that a specific extract of the cabbage family, which is sulforaphane glucosinolate, or SGS, has an anti-cancer effect. So that could be helpful. There is actually some evidence that lycopene may make a difference. It seems to help prevent prostate cancer in men, but also breast cancer in women. And fish oil may have a preventive effect. We may want to use flaxseed. There's a product called Breveil, suggesting that it, with B-R-E as the initial three letters, suggesting that it protects the breasts. So that might be a useful thing to take, or just take fresh ground flaxseed in your diet.
Yes.
And then when it comes to
flaxseed ligands, yep.
And then when it comes to diet, what does the evidence lead us on that?
Well, take home message is cancer loves sugar. You want to give up that daily dessert. You want to save it for your special occasions. You want to eat a very, very clean diet. Organics are in order, grass fed, pasture raised, all of the above is in order. Keeping juices, smoothies, things like that, because those are concentrated sources of sugar, to a minimum. I do want to mention, Kathy, if you're overweight, that's one of the first places to start. Mm-hmm. If you are a little insulin resistant, there is we do have the knowledge that insulin and cancer are intimately related. You want to make sure that you get yourself to a healthy weight.
Exactly.
And one of the ways to do that is to cut out all the refined carbs, sugars, and all of that.
And that may be actually one of the ways that exercise exerts its beneficial effects on the risk of certain cancers, whereby it helps to tame high levels of insulin. Insulin spawns IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor, and that's a growth factor that can promote cancer proliferation. So that would be something to consider. And what about the role of dairy? Controversial?
Dairy is controversial. Dairy has a lot of growth factors and meant for an infant. And the controversy is, what happens when we as adults are continuing to take in dairy? What are all these growth factors doing in our bodies? Is it possibly feeding a tumor? So I would be a fan of keep the dairy to an absolute minimum. I wouldn't drink milk anymore because milk contains a sugar. It's called lactose. Keep cheese intake to an absolute minimum, or give it up altogether, quite honestly.
Exactly.
And then people say, well, where am I going to get my probiotics? I can't have my yogurt. Well, there is plenty of probiotic foods. Lactic acid fermented pickles, you've got sauerkraut, there's kimchi. It doesn't have to be all about dairy. Also, coconut milk kefir or coconut milk yogurt might be a good substitute for probiotics, as well as taking a probiotic supplement. But dairy is a big question mark. What are your thoughts?
I think that it's a reasonable supposition that the mammary gland secretion of a large-bodied animal might not be suitable for a human who's concerned about a mammary gland tumor. I'm just saying, you know, there may be certain factors there that may somewhat increase the risk of cancer. The concern is that if it's not organic, and it's very hard to find organic dairy, if you have lots of butter and cheese, you're going to get a lot of environmental chemicals that are concentrated in the fat of the milk. And that may be one of the biggest downsides of dairy fat. I'm not personally opposed to dairy fat. I use a lot of organic butter myself. But the concern is that if it comes from the wrong source, that many of these chemicals are xenoestrogens, and they may be responsible for our current epidemic of prostate cancer in men. There is some suspicion that prostate cancer may be linked to dairy intake, and also breast cancer in women. These are both hormonally sensitive tissues, you know, the breast tissue as well as the prostate tissue, and so I would forego the dairy. But, you know, this is actually, we're going above and beyond the question. She just wants to know how to get through the surgery. She'll breeze through the surgery with the supplements that we suggest. Mm-hmm. So what's the next question?
Okay, next question we have is from Steve. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I will be 70 years old this year and have been on metoprolol for heart rate and blood pressure for several years. I do weight-bearing and aerobic exercise on a daily basis, but I'm limited in achieving any improvements because the metoprolol puts the brakes on my heart rate. Is there any way to improve my level of exercise given the limiting heart rate effects of the metoprolol? Thank you.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's not so much a nutritional question as a medical question. Is when you're taking a beta blocker, you will reduce your ability to allow your heart to speed up. And that's intentional mm-hmm. because the beta blocker is designed to keep your blood pressure down, but also sometimes to control your heart rate. Beta blockers are often given in the immediate aftermath of heart attacks because they know that stress on the heart or rapid heartbeat is mm-hmm. likely to precipitate an arrhythmia or perhaps a second heart attack. So you kind of it's a way to cushion the heart from stress or excessive exercise demands. And so in a way, it's counterproductive. When you're trying to condition yourself. And, of course, you want to condition yourself after a heart event or if you have a heart problem. So by taking the beta blocker, you protect your heart, but in a way you may undermine your heart by not getting the full benefits of exercise. So I see it as a little bit of a conundrum. In many cases,
There's no real way around that, is there?
Well, if it's possible to get the patient off the beta blocker, yes. So sometimes, it's very easy to put patients on medication, and it's much harder to take them off. And so one of the things I will do is I'll do a second opinion on all the medications a patient is taking. And if I can safely remove a medication, look, I'm not taking patients off willy-nilly. This is one of the reasons that I went to medical school. So, I knew that even before I went to medical school, I was in general in favor of natural therapies. But I had to understand the conventional therapies before I could deal with patients who are on multiple drugs. And when you have an understanding of what the drugs are there to do, sometimes you realize that a drug is essential. Or you have the perspective to say this drug is no longer essential, it's getting in the way of the patient's full recovery. Mm-hmm. So is there a way around this? There's no real way around this, but I'll say reassuringly that there's after anyone has a heart attack, they immediately go to cardiac rehabilitation, and virtually all the patients just had a heart attack are on beta blockers, and I would say that the cardiac rehab is still extremely beneficial with or without the beta blocker. So it doesn't completely obviate or eliminate the benefits of the exercise. It may blunt some of the benefits, but that's, for safety's sake.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Steve. So continue exercising. Stay on your metoprolol.
Yeah.
That would be that. Okay. Do we have time for another question?
Well, we do, and we'll take one more question in part one of our weekly Q&A with you, Layla, and then we'll take a pause and we'll return. But give us one more question, we'll answer that, and then we'll go to part two.
Okay. This is an email from Raymond Lee. Hi, Doc, he says. I don't know how much you are familiar with when it comes to eye problems, but I thought you might know if there are any treatments or drugs to eliminate or decrease floaters, which bounce around endlessly in both of my eyes. My eye doctor did perform a Lazar procedure
Laser procedure.
Oh gosh,
yeah.
That's right.
Right.
A laser procedure.
He spelled it wrong, and you just kind of went with it.
He spelled it wrong, and I just said it.
That was named after the famous Dr. Lazar.
Lazar, right?
Yes.
To close up a crack in the back of one of my eyes, which he said allowed the floaters to enter. Is there, what else can I do about this? He's researched online on numerous occasions.
I got to say, this is really a problem because I wish, for almost everything in medicine, there's a plausible supplement. There's supplements for high blood pressure. There's supplements for high cholesterol. There's supplements for dry skin, and on it goes. And it sounds like, okay, I've got this condition, so I'll just, Dr. Hoff must know a surefire cure for this condition with the perfect supplement. I got to say that in my pretty darn near 30-year career in the field of complementary alternative medicine, I haven't found something reliably that treats floaters. Floaters are generally changes in what's called the vitreous. The vitreous is a gel that is inside the eyeball, and it tends to thicken and dry up as you age, which happens to most body parts, sort of as an inevitable process of aging. And one might suspect that if you take plenty of essential fatty acids, maybe that'll do sort of a lube job on your eye, and your vitreous will remain nice and clear and springy and not thicken and create little pulls on your retina, which can sometimes lead to retinal detachment. Short of that, you might experience floaters. But I really got to say, I'm not, somebody comes up with a surefire way of treating that, I'd like to be the first one you contact.
Yeah.
I can't tell you. I just think there's a little bit of an inevitability to that. I do notice, however, that when people are in generally better health, they can go many more years before experiencing floaters.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a little bit of a merit system in terms of a healthy diet and proper exercise that, you know, exercise, of course, may enhance circulation of the eye. But I don't think it's entirely a merit system.
I see. But I wonder if the regular eye supplements would be somehow helpful, at least in keeping the eye healthy so the vitreous...
You know, I'm going to be very conservative about it. You know, it's like eye health supplements are specifically designed to treat two conditions. They've actually been shown to help two conditions. One, maybe three. One is macular degeneration. There's actually lots of evidence that these eye health supplements with lutein and zeaxanthin and antioxidants and selenium and DHA from fish oil, that these prevent macular degeneration. Also, there's some evidence that antioxidants prevent cataracts or slow the development
yes.
of cataracts.
Yes.
Then when it comes to other disorders, you know, maybe night blindness is helped by certain things like bilberry,
vitamin A,
mm-hmm. vitamin A, and so on. But
not,
you know,
floaters. Yeah.
Yeah. Floaters. I mean, not everything is amenable to a natural therapy. So I'll just be quite honest on that. I'm not sure what's going to make a difference.
Okay,
so this is a logical point for us to break. This is part one of our weekly Q&A with Layla, soon to be followed by part two. Give us a preview of additional questions. What's coming up next?
Oh, next we have a topic about a vegetarian form of DHA.
All right. Mm-hmm. Up next on part two of Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.